You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 16th of June 2015 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, an Egyptian court upholds the death sentence passed last month against former President Mohamed Morsi and other senior Muslim Brotherhood figures. My guests today, Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman, will discuss that and the day's other top stories, including...
We've got to send different messages about the importance of educating our girls. You know, our sons are important. We love men. We all do. They're good. They're useful. I have one in my life. I like him.
Michelle Obama visits the UK in her role as an advocate for female education, while also in London, the strange life of a less distinguished First Lady comes to a premature end. We'll be asking what role presidential spouses should expect and be expected to play. Later in the show, we'll look at whether Narendra Modi's Yoga Day initiative is just a day for yoga or Hindu nationalism by other means, and wonder how exportable an idea Russian fast food might be. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are, it's a terrible phrase, guests today. We should stop writing those two words together. Martin Plaut, fellow at the Institute of Commonwealth Studies, and Jeffrey Kaufman, author and commentator. Welcome both. We will start in Egypt, where a court has upheld last month's death sentence passed against former President Mohamed Morsi. Five other leading members of the Muslim Brotherhood, including its spiritual leader Mohamed Badi, have also had their death sentences confirmed. And lest there be any doubt that Morsi is going anywhere in the interim, he's also been sentenced to life imprisonment for spying for Hamas, among other foreign Islamist groups. Martin, I'll ask you first, and you know, this is by no means apparently the end of the legal road. There's apparently still an appeals court that he is planning to appeal to, because frankly, why wouldn't you? Is the Egyptian regime basically just trying to keep Morsi suspended now in this legal limbo?
Well, I think so, because I mean, it would seem to me to be an enormous error to actually execute him and turn him into a martyr. I mean, why? What do you gain by doing it? So, you know, the Egyptian legal process is extraordinarily slow. You can keep it going for one heck of a long time. And who knows, if you finally got to a point where you might execute him, what about a presidential pardon? All of a sudden the president looks magnanimous, wonderful man, and you've got your prisoner sitting in jail. What's there not to like about that?
That's a terribly cynical but almost certainly entirely accurate analysis of what has happened and is about to. Jeffrey, have the Egyptians pinned themselves into a bit of a corner here, where obviously they wanted to make a terrific example of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, but as Martin points out, if they actually hang the bloke and his associates, then you do rather create more trouble for yourself than you might have solved.
You know, I think it's really the audacity of hopelessness in Egypt. It's just so you know, having covered the Arab Spring and briefly tasted that you know, just a morsel of optimism in that region, to see where it is now and to see Egypt having slid back. I mean, one of the great ironies of what we're seeing with this preposterous death sentence is, you know, what about Hosni Mubarak and his sons and his henchmen? I mean,
he's still alive, right?
Yes, he's in a prison hospital. He's an old man. I think he broke his hip or his leg. He's got 2 or 3 years left in his corruption sentence, and his boys do too. I mean, are you really going to look me in the eye and tell me that the sins that he committed in all those decades of dictatorship are any less than what Morsi is being sentenced to death for? The reality is that the Egyptians, the government under Sisi, do not like, as Mubarak didn't, the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're trying to figure out ways to crush them. But what we've known since the 1920s is that this is a group that just will not be put down. It's the sort of the political equivalent of whack-a-mole. You know, you can slap one area and they'll come up in another through their charities, whatever. And I think Martin's absolutely right. It would be absolute folly to execute this man. In fact, it was very interesting. When the sentence came down, he was smiling, and you wonder whether he almost thought, maybe I'm going to be a martyr.
On that thought of attempting to crush the Muslim Brotherhood, it has, as Jeffrey points out, whatever one may or may not think of its aims, ideas and objectives, it proved astonishingly resilient under the Mubarak decades, where it was repressed, oppressed, harassed, etc., etc., and it just would not go away. Is al-Sisi kidding himself if he thinks he can actually expunge the Muslim Brotherhood from Egypt forever?
Oh, I think so, because, I mean, you know, essentially they were the welfare state. There was no other welfare state in Egypt, but they provided what passed for a welfare state. If people were poor, they provided them with help, they provided them with food, they gave, you know, legal advice and all sorts of services to people when the state provided absolutely nothing. But, I mean, I think there's one thing we shouldn't kind of forget about this, is that the, you know, the Egyptian courts are not independent. Like most African courts, they do what the president bids them to do. And I think one of the most worrying things about what happened with Omar al-Bashir yesterday, when he was flown out of South Africa, you know, despite a court saying that he was not to, was the fact that, you know, here you had a court being yet again, another African court being ignored by a president. And this means that the number of places in Africa where actually the judiciary is genuinely separate and genuinely has a hold over life, and, you know, the president has to worry about them, is shrinking. It's just shrunk by one. And I think that is a very, very serious development.
I think one of the things you also have to understand in Egypt and North Africa in particular, that have gone through these tumultuous years of the so-called Arab Spring, is that for so many of these countries now, maybe Tunisia is the exception, the life is worse. You know, of course it was terrible under the dictator, but now the insecurity, the instability, has made life miserable for many more people on a daily basis. Just getting bread, going to getting your children to school, trying to get work, and so, you know, what al-Sisi has going for him is that he has somewhat stabilized Egypt, and that, as uncomfortable as it is, you know, in your day-to-day life, if you keep your head low, it's a little easier now than it was 2 years ago. And that is actually a powerful card, I think, in these countries. I remember in Iraq when this happened, that you know, people, I remember people saying, well, at least under Saddam, I didn't have to worry about my children being blown up, you know, coming home from school.
I remember hearing much the same thing. I think for people making the grand schemes, it's very easy to forget how prized just basic stability is to an awful lot of people who will trade that for an awful lot of other freedoms.
Well, particularly the chaos. I mean, you know, obviously Libya is even more profoundly dysfunctional than Egypt. But yeah. And so, you know, al-Sisi's iron fist, which goes back to Mubarak and before him Nasser, does at least return that. But I think that essentially we're back where Egypt was, what, 5-10 years ago. You've got a powerful dictator trying to crush the Muslim Brotherhood, and the Muslim Brotherhood not being crushable, if I can use that word.
And I think one other thing is, of course, that the West is clearly perfectly happy with the situation. I mean, the President Obama has just released, what is it, $1.3 billion worth of weapons for the Egyptians. The thumbs up is there.
On that subject, though, is al-Sisi's determination to be seen by the West as the proverbial man with whom we can do business, is that ultimately the best guarantor of Morsi's life at this point? Because it's easily imaginable that the West might tolerate Morsi being locked up for the term of his natural, but the West really could not be seen to be endorsing his execution,
could they? Yeah, I think that's right. I think it would be insane for anybody to go along with turning him into yet another great leader who's, you know, been put to death. It would be appalling.
And just a final thought on that, Jeffrey. Sort of Egypt's recently reacquired Western allies, will they or should they say anything about Morsi and what should or shouldn't happen to him?
I think, if there's anything we've learned in the last decade, it's that, you know, you can't tell these countries how to behave, and yet you can't push them away because, you know, you've got to keep your friends closer and your enemies closer. You just simply can't function in a world order without communication and cooperation from a country as big and as important as Egypt. I mean, it is the biggest country by population in its region, and it's just too pivotal to push away and say, oh, we don't like what you're doing. We're going to cut off. We're going to cut you off. I mean, that was, of course, you know, I covered Cuba for years. And, you know, the thing about Cuba was it didn't really matter. You could put sanctions against Cuba because, after all, what did it really matter? 10 million people on a tropical island. But you know, when you're dealing with Egypt, when you're dealing with some of the oil states, the gas states like Qatar, where the U.S. fleet is based, these countries have the U.S. They have a power that you know we don't like to acknowledge, that the West needs these countries, and therefore they can get away with a lot while we wag our fingers.
Okay, well, let's look now at the UK, which this week finds itself playing host to something of a tale of two first ladies. The world's most powerful incumbent in such a role, Michelle Obama, is visiting on behalf of her Let Girls Learn initiative, which acts in the unarguable cause of helping more girls into education. At the other end of the scale of presidential spouses, however, Sarah Kyalaba, the last surviving widow of unlamented Ugandan tyrant Idi Amin, died in Palmer's Green, aged 59. She had most recently been running a hairdresser's in Tottenham. Michelle Obama, first of all, Martin, I'll ask you first, should somebody have such cachet just because the person to whom they happen to be married does an important job?
Well, I think it's sort of inevitable. I mean, there is only one Obama family in the world, and, you know, wherever he or she went, they were bound to have that kind of cachet. You know, if Mrs. Putin arrived in London, don't you think everybody would stop and the place would grind to a halt?
Well, see, I'm not sure they would, and I'm just wondering why America's is such a special case. I'm wondering how many Americans out of a given 100 could tell you the name of the wife of the Prime Minister of the United Kingdom.
Well, there is a simple reason why Americans, it's the case, because the U.S. has, the head of state and the head of government are one, and
Indeed, so.
When you have a presidential system like that, it is one of the things that confuses values in the U.S. Here in the U.K., of course, you have the Queen as head of state and the Prime Minister as head of the government. And so, you know, there is this kind of monarchic role of the White House. Martin's right. What are you going to do about it? And at least she stands for good causes. And in fairness, you know, first ladies, really since Eleanor Roosevelt, have done terrific jobs championing the underdog, championing important causes. And so I find it pretty hard to fault, you know, whatever, Republican, Democrat. George Bush's wife, Laura Bush, took on literacy. I mean, how can you fault for campaigning for child literacy?
And or the famous slogan of Lady Bird Johnson, every litter bit hurts.
But, you know, that was a campaign that worked. I mean, they really changed American culture when it came to what we called pollution in those days. So, you know, I more power to her. I mean, what's comical now, of course, is that Michelle Obama is such a powerhouse with what she wears. And so, you know, I find it amazing. She can put on a J. Crew dress, and suddenly J. Crew runs out of those dresses. And it's, they're sending word to Bangladesh to make another 20,000 of them because they're going to go off the shelf. But this is the presidentialization, the queen for a day, queen for 8 years.
We should consider the somewhat or relatively melancholy life story of Sarah Kyalaba, who first attracted the eye of Idi Amin when she was a go-go dancer with the Revolutionary Suicide Mechanized Regiment Band of the Ugandan military. Shortly after ceasing to be Mrs. Amin, she was a lingerie model in Germany, later moved to London where she became proprietor of a cafe most recently, apparently a quite well-regarded hairdresser in Tottenham. Is there something of a caution here, do we think, though, against marrying presidents? It really can go one of two ways.
Can't it just? But I mean, you know, if she had a bad end, what about Simone Gbagbo, who was, is jailed now for 20 years for her part in Laurent Gbagbo's terrible regime in Ivory Coast, you know, overthrown in 2010, and she's now spending 20 years in jail. So she's by no means the only. I mean, she was the power. Simone Gbagbo was the power behind the throne, and plenty of people died because she looked at them the wrong way. But at the other end of the spectrum, of course, who can forget Imelda Marcos? I mean, you know, and her wonderful shoes. I think there's a lot to be said for her.
I think it's a question of choosing, obviously, your future presidential spouse wisely. But we are looking, you know, quite potentially next year at the extremely peculiar situation in which the...
I want to know where this is going. Well, I'm worried. I'm really worried. Can I go get a coffee before you finish this question?
The next First Lady of the United States, as it were, might not only be a man, but actually a former president. We may have a couple addressed formally...
Women, not Bruce Jenner.
We may have a couple addressed as Ms. and Mr. President, which is what Hillary and Bill Clinton would be. What potential role, I'll ask you first, Jeffrey, would Bill possibly occupy in that role?
You know, he's so popular now, at least apart from the Clinton haters. He plays you know, the elder statesman, and he revels in it. He loves it. He still is an incredibly charismatic guy. It's interesting to know what he'll do. But there are too many ifs in that question for me. I mean, I do not think it's a foregone conclusion that Hillary Clinton is going to win that election. So you're right, it would be a fascinating scenario. But listen, Jeb Bush's wife is a very complicated woman herself, who has a very complicated. I believe she's Mexican American. She is had some shoplifting issues. You know, sadly, one of his sons was just arrested over the weekend. You know, he has a very checkered family. He's got a daughter who's had emotional problems. You know, this is real life. And so Jeb Bush would bring a colorful White House with him, our family to the White House.
A final thought on this, I guess, before we take a short break, Martin. For the voters, do you think, of a given democracy, how much should they look at the family of somebody who wants to lead the country?
Well, the one thing you don't want is somebody who's going to embarrass you and your country. And that is, you know, something you really have to watch out for. And I think we must return to Imelda Marcos and her wonderful statement when she said, with people, they either love, love, love you, or they hate, hate, hate you. And wasn't she right?
That sounds like a pop song on Monocle.
And if it isn't, it probably very shortly will be. We are going to take a short break right now. You are listening to Midori House here on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller, along with Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman. Coming up next, Narendra Modi discovers that yoga is more controversial than he might have imagined, and we wonder whether the world is ready for Russian takeaway food.
The idea behind the Foreign Desk is very simple. We take one issue each week, find people who know all about it, and then let them talk.
He was one of the few leaders who didn't have blood on his hands. All the warlords had committed crimes against other ethnic groups.
There are no sound bites. We don't want to set up arguments. We just want to explore some pretty complex issues with some great guests who can explain things in plain English.
For as long as I've been involved with the Security Council, Russia has frankly been malign in its intent. I don't think it's ever done anything good or useful on the Council.
Sometimes it's the big news story. Sometimes we pick a subject that no one else is covering. Either way, we do it in depth.
He promised to eliminate poppy cultivation and the trafficking of drugs. Last year saw a record harvest in Afghanistan. I think it was worth almost $1 billion.
That's The Foreign Desk with me, Steve Bloomfield, airing every Saturday at 12 noon London time. Also available at any time on monocle.com.
Who are the young designers you should be looking out for? Who's leading the way when it comes to architecture, fashion, product and interior design? And what lessons from design history should we all be taking note of?
He really was an artist whose medium of expression was fashion.
I could never live in a place that I designed because I'm not designing for myself.
You look for where there is a potential for creativity, for poetry. So architectural lighting, where the dialogue with architecture can become something very interesting.
Monocle 24's design programme Section D delves deep into the places, communities and manufacturers that make the design industry what it is. From trade shows to trend forecasts, tune in every Tuesday and make Section D the object of your attention.
And you're welcome back to Midori House here on Monocle 24. Still with me, Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman. Now, this coming Sunday is the first International Yoga Day. It is in part a pet project of Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi, who urged its institution before the United Nations last year, claiming that yoga, and I quote, is not about exercise, but to discover the sense of oneness with ourselves, the world and nature. By changing our lifestyle and creating consciousness, it can help us to deal with climate change. In India itself, however, this ostensibly harmless initiative has played badly with sections of the country's Muslim population who suspect some species of Hindu plot. Martin, do they have a point here? Is this just a day about yoga, or does Narendra Modi have a more sinister agenda?
He does. It is.
All right, so let's go get a drink now.
No,
that's sorted out.
Okay.
One mustn't forget that, you know, yoga is very much part of not just the whole Hindu culture, and of course should be respected as that, but, you know, to make it like almost a national religion, which is what he's effectively doing, is really worrying. The other thing one shouldn't forget is that the neo-fascist RSS, which is kind of behind Modi but never there in public, uses yoga every day as part of its, you know, literally, you know, they march up and down, they do yoga, these kind of things. And they also claim, would you believe, that that yoga can cure cancer, as well as, of course, homosexuality, that other thing that we need to cure.
Well, these are among the claims made by Narendra Modi's preferred guru, one H.R. Nagendra. We did talk there, Jeffrey, about what a potential leader may bring to a job in terms of their family. I think it's also fairly reasonable to be concerned about the other company they keep. One is rather put in mind here of Ronald Reagan's bizarre associations with various astrologers. But Mr. Nagendra claims that yoga has cured cancer, homosexuality as well, and asthma. How worried are we if the Prime Minister of a serious country like India is regularly consulting with an absurd quack of this species?
Well, I mean, come on, you know, this happens in Western countries, too, as
indeed
you noted,
so.
Ronald Reagan. And, you know, I don't think I think on one level, there's a kind of Hindu nationalism happening here, which can be alarming. On another level, this is part of politics and pandering that goes on in any democracy or emerging democracy. I mean, I think we're talking about it because it is slightly entertaining in a bizarre way. I mean, it's a little bit silly. Let's face it. He's created a ministry of yoga, and in fact, one of the extraordinary things that I read was that the minister of yoga was quoted as saying, "This is yoga is India's greatest contribution to the world since zero." And of course, if you know your history of mathematics, zero is in fact as a number. Is in fact credited to the Indian people in about 600 to 900 AD. So I actually thought maybe he should be taken to task for that, suggesting that India has done nothing in the last 1,500 years, apart from yoga and zero, to improve the world, which I think is a bit unfair.
But, you know, I think one has to be a little bit cautious because, you know, I spent a year in Delhi, and, you know, the tensions that there are, the real tensions that underlie relations between Muslims and Hindus in India are really serious. And, you know, people can die in their hundreds if the wrong signal is sent out. And that is why I think it is worrying when you get, you know, essentially, yoga is a form of religion as much as Hinduism is a form of religion, because Hinduism, people argue, is not a religion, but let's leave that aside. You know, it's such a complicated faith, and it's such a complicated part of Indian society. But, you know, these underlying tensions are real. They can lead to many deaths, and that is why I think it is a mistake to force it down somebody's throat. I mean, Indira Gandhi had her own guru. She never flew without him. So it's not as if, you know, I'm not trying to sort of suggest that it should be left aside from Indian culture, but it should not be a state religion in that way.
Is there, though, something, Jeffrey, I'll put this to you, to get vaguely concerned about when you do have a plan? I mean, everyone's stressing that it's not compulsory, but nonetheless, bureaucrats, civil servants, politicians, all being encouraged to participate, and obviously you could argue that getting people to participate in exercise, fine. Does this start to get a bit odd? Cultish.
Well, it's a bit messianic, let's face it.
It's about
not just imposing exercise but values and culture, and so yeah, it's not a terrific thing to be seen going on, but I have to say, not to sort of ruin the party here, but I, you know, the issues in India, you know, around the treatment of women and sexual abuse and violence and rape, you know, are so profoundly disturbing that you know, this is a mild issue on the
and nothing comes close to caste.
Okay, well, we shall wish, however, India all the best with National Yoga Day.
How are you
going to
make this segue? I want to hear how you're going to go from that to Russian blinis.
I'm not even going to try. What I'm going to say is that we have finished discussing Indian yoga. We are now going to discuss Russian blinis. There you are. It's like no audible grinding of the gears. Because, yes, indeed, undaunted by the fact that Russia's behaviour abroad this last year or so has not exactly constituted a charm offensive, one Mikhail Goncharov, the founder of Russia's largest chain of blini emporia, Taramok, is planning to open branches in Manhattan. Jeffrey, do you think that Americans are going to take to Russian fast food?
Well, I have to say that when I read about this, I kind of thought, gee, you know, I think I might go there. I'm not a fast food guy, but I think it sounds kind of fun. And, you know, why not? I think that the notion of blini diplomacy is pushing it a bit, to say the least. I think he's just a smart entrepreneur. And let's face it, it's going to depend on the quality or the taste of his food and the pricing and what it looks like. But, I why not? McDonald's colonized Russia and the Soviet Union very early on. And, why not a little bit of reverse bliniism? I think it's brilliant, but whether or not this is going to help Putin, I think it's a little bit pushing it to say that.
I can remember visiting McDonald's in Moscow in 1996, six years after it opened, and there were still queues around the block.
I lived in Moscow in 97, and I actually went there only because I, for some reason, thought maybe it would be interesting to try, and then I realized it actually tasted just as bad
like
there
McDonald's,
as it did everywhere else.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think those queues I saw around the block had actually been there since 1990, but in Russia, it can sometimes be difficult to tell. Blini diplomacy, as Jeffrey mentioned there, Martin, Mikhail Goncharov, the entrepreneur behind this, he has made the sort of speeches about sort of reaching out to America and how food can bring people together. I think I've detected a slightly arched eyebrow and smirk while he is so doing. But does the current international climate, which is somewhat chilly vis-a-vis Russia and almost everybody else, will it make any difference to his business, do you think?
Oh, I can't believe it. I mean, you know, as long as the blinis are good, I can't see New Yorkers turning them down. I'm sure they'll be delightful. Of course, I don't know have Nando's reached America yet?
Nando's. It's a chicken thing.
Thank you. Yeah, Nando's is a British thing. You know, there's a great...
It's not. It's a South Africa. It's our great South African export, and you didn't notice.
Oh,
Is it South Africa?
Absolutely.
I want to publicly apologise for
not thank you.
Knowing
we're feeling much better.
Devastated.
The only time I've ever set foot in a Nando's was in Swaziland.
It is disgusting, I must say.
but you know, if we're going to talk about chains, let me see if I can remember the name of it. There is a fried chicken chain in Guatemala, and when I covered Latin America and was based in Miami, every time you went to Guatemala on a flight, on the way back, all of the overhead lockers would be filled with these packages of fried chicken. The whole plane smelled like a fried chicken place because it was such a cult. And they've since opened in Miami, so you don't actually have to smuggle it in anymore. But, you know, these cults of, you know, people love their local foods, and they're totally, you know, in awe of the comforts of home or the exotic from other homes. So, well, more power to blini diplomacy, I say.
Indeed, and I look forward to the days when in New York you'll be able to get golgappas, which are the most wonderful sort of golf ball size things that Indians produce, full of green liquid and chickpeas, and you push your thumb into them and you pour in sort of curries and things and you put it in your mouth. It's like a taste explosion.
You can't get that in Brick Lane?
You can get them in some places, but the only real ones are in the back streets of Delhi, and they're absolutely delicious.
I mean, for reasons surpassing my understanding, month before last in Cyprus, there's an Australian coffee chain called Gloria Jean's, open in Nicosia. Amazing. Bizarre. Inexplicable.
So we're pleased to announce that next week we will be coming from the streets of India, where we will do a special edition of Monocle Radio with, is it Golgappas?
Golgappas, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Suits me fine. I fear we have deviated from our original point, whatever that was, somewhat. But thank you both very much for joining me, Martin Plaut and Jeffrey Kaufman. That is all we have time for on today's edition of Midori House. It was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Mariana Zuniga. Our studio manager was Chris Chilvers. For the next half hour, Daniel Giacopelli is here with Monocle's International Playlist. At 1900 hours, Josh Fennett presents Section D. At 2200, I'm back with Emma Nelson for the Monocle Daily. Midori House returns 1800 London time tomorrow. But for this edition, it's goodbye. Thanks for listening.